This week, a government budget agreement on Capitol Hill renewed investors' appetites for the precious metals. Welcome back to GoldSeek.com Radio, everyone. Your host, Chris Waltzek, with you for another big holiday season show. Will the Fed Grinch steal Christmas this year? Well, investors seem to think so. Stocks registered one of the sharpest sell-offs ahead of next week's FOMC meeting. But some of those funds were directed to the precious metals markets. God, as Bill Murphy says, that the gold decline is presenting excellent buying opportunities across the board. So just how much is the national debt? Currently, it's over $17 trillion. A staggering sum when one considers that it's more than the annual GDP. But hold on to your hat. My next guest says the true national debt is over $220 trillion. That's about 15 years of everything produced in the country when unfunded government programs are included. Professor Lawrence Kotlikoff makes his debut appearance on the show. He outlines his INFORM Act, designed to encourage government responsibility and avoid profligacy. Then Robert Ian wraps up the show with another must-hear editorial. GoldSeek.com Radio begins now with the Market Weatherman Report. Partly sunny skies appeared over the precious metals exchanges this week. Following an impressive rebound rally early in the week, concerns that the Fed could curtail QE-related purchases took some air out of the market. Premiums in China climbed, though, on Chinese New Year-related purchases. Premiums at the Shanghai Gold Exchange remained elevated $30 over spot gold. At Friday's closing bell on the New York COMEX Exchange, the yellow metal added about $8, finishing the week near $12.38 an ounce. Silver picked up about 12 cents, finishing at $19.66 an ounce. Meanwhile, after increasing precious metals positions early in the week, by Friday, most of those profits evaporated as traders flattened positions ahead of next week's Federal Reserve meeting, slated for December 17th through the 18th. While many market watchers agree that Fed tapering of the $85 billion in monthly bond purchases is already baked into the market price, uncertainty has the markets and some investors on edge. The Federal Reserve is printing nearly $20 billion every single week. Unless Fed governors taper sharply, little market reaction is expected next week. However, J.P. Morgan analysts lowered their forecasts on gold by 10% to $12.63 an ounce for next year, and they lowered their expectations for silver a bit as well. Higher bond yields, particularly on the long end, have turned investors to stocks, making safe haven investments less attractive. The Fed may begin reducing its bond purchases, according to 34% of economists in a recent Bloomberg survey. That was twice the number of the previous poll. However, a Labor Department report showed wholesale prices declined for the third month, indicating tame inflation, giving the Fed wiggle room with regard to stimulus measures. On Friday, wholesale prices declined for the third month in a row. The producer price index was off 0.1% in November. Elsewhere, the U.S. House passed a federal budget plan on Thursday to support the economy and to avoid a government shutdown. Republican and Democratic congressional legislators agreed to reduce the federal deficit by almost $23 billion over a 10-year period, while boosting the spending limit by $63 over the next 2 years. The U.S. national debt is now over $17 trillion and climbing, with unfunded liabilities, Social Security, Medicare, and Medicaid, in excess of $220 trillion, according to some sources. Elsewhere, the threat of bail-ins just reached a new threshold on news from across the pond of a European Union bail-in agreement for bank bailouts, euphemistically known as bail-ins. Officials expect the program to take effect in 2016. However, emergency conditions could require immediate funding from shareholders and depositors. The European Parliament stated that depositors with more than 100,000 euros, that's about $140,000, would be bailed in after shareholders and bondholders. However, one sharp market watcher suggested that all funds, regardless of balance, could be on the chopping block under dire circumstances. Just one more solid reason to buy gold and silver at these phenomenally low prices. Bottom line on the precious metals. Well, the U.S. dollar put in a solid technical performance this week, while there were signs of distribution in the metals. So please be sure and log in no later than Monday afternoon for important updates with regard to the market action. Moving on to the Wall Street Report, cloudy skies hovered over the New York Stock Exchange for the second week running. The Dow Jones Industrials fell sharply below key support at 16,000 by Friday's close. As the session bell rang out over the NYSE, the Dow Jones Industrials shed 264 points, ending at 15,755. The S&P 500 dropped 30 points, ending at 1775, off about 1.65%, while the NASDAQ actually shed 61 points, about 1.51% for the week, ending just above the 4,000 point. The top story impacting the stock bourses this week was news that the House passed a budget, putting limits on automatic spending cuts to avoid another government shutdown. Entitlement programs and corporate tax breaks, however, pleased both political parties. However, the plan must be approved still by the Senate and the President. The act was viewed as a sign of harmony among the bipartisan rancor, leading investors to book profits in anticipation that the Fed could use it as an excuse to curb stimulus efforts at next week's FOMC meeting. Bottom line on Wall Street. Well, according to the 7-component Fear Sentiment Index, fear is re-entering the markets, but is not yet quite overextended. Although the sell-off was intense, we still have positive seasonal factors, including holiday shopping, that'll likely bring investors back from the sidelines, assuming that the FOMC throws no curveballs next week. Coming up after the break, more GoldSeek.com radio with Professor Kotlikoff and Bill Murphy, so we want you to stay with us here at GoldSeek. Well, my special guest today says that it's time for the government to stop kicking the can down the road. Eventually, the can could kick back. It's a pleasure to welcome Dr. Lawrence Kotlikoff in his debut appearance here on the show, professor of economics at Boston University and the author of The Inform Act, focused on improving the welfare of every American. Welcome, Professor Kotlikoff.
Thanks. It's very nice to be with you. Let me just set the record a little bit straight.
Sure.
The Inform Act is a bill that two senators are the authors of. That's Senator Kane, a Democrat from Virginia, and Senator Thune, a Republican from South Dakota. So they're the actual authors. I helped write the bill. The bill was kind of initiated by a millennial group, a youth group in Washington called The Can Kicks Back. These folks, young people, decided that they should have a voice in how they're going to be treated. They started to visit with different offices of the different members of Congress, and they eventually ran into Senator Thune's staff, and they got him interested in what I proposed that they put forward as this bill, which is to require the CBO and GAO and OMB to do honest fiscal accounting to specify every year what our long-term fiscal gap is. And that fiscal gap is something that economists believe we should be measuring. It's saying how much does the government owe, not just what's on the books, but on everything that's not on the books, just not now and not next year, but throughout time into the future? What's the present value of all those spending commitments, and how do they compare with the taxes that are scheduled to come in? So what's the difference, all the spending that's projected to be made and all the taxes that are projected to come in? What's our fiscal gap? And that's the true measure of our fiscal debt. And that number is about $205 trillion large right now. The official debt in the hands of the public, in comparison, is only $12 trillion large. So you see that we're hiding most of our bills.
It's very well said, and I appreciate that overview of the Inform Act. You know, your work indicates the current generation could be the first in national history to be actually worse off economically than their predecessors. According to 15 Nobel laureates in economics, all of whom endorsed the Inform Act, could you give us more details now on the fiscal gap measures?
So it takes into account all the spending. It's very simple. It's like double bookkeeping entry. The government has obligations to pay principal plus interest on all the outstanding treasury bonds and bills. That's the official debt, and it has a certain present value, and that's the current 12-point-something trillion of debt in the hands of the public. But the government also has obligations to make Medicare payments, to provide for defense, to pay for the Supreme Court justices' salaries. Has all kinds of obligations, Social Security benefits. These are just as real, in some ways more real than paying off the debt, because you can inflate away the debt. Social Security benefits are indexed inflation. You can't really pay, not pay soldiers and military. So all these things represent obligations out into the future, and they need to all be on the books, and that's what the fiscal gap analysis does. It puts everything onto the books, all the spending commitments, and then it forms the value in the present of those spending commitments, and it compares that with the value in the present of all the taxes that are projected to be paid to cover those commitments. And we use the Congressional Budget Office's long-term alternative fiscal scenario projection. So we're using the CBO's data. They're projecting out 75 years, which we then extend beyond that. When you look at the fiscal gap, it's, as I mentioned, $205 trillion large. That's many times larger than the $12 trillion official debt. It's to come up with $205 trillion to really cover, to come up with the additional taxes needed to cover all the scheduled spending, as projected by the CBO, we need to raise taxes by 57% immediately and permanently, every single federal tax. This is an indication of how bankrupt the country is. We're really talking here about 10.3% of GDP on an ongoing basis that we're short. And this is why the economics profession, if you go to the informact.org, T-H-E-I-N-F-O-R-M-A-C-T.org, theinformact.org, you'll see 1,000-plus economists who've signed up to endorse the bill. You'll see 15 of those are Nobel Prize winners in economics. You'll see George Shultz's endorsement. You'll see endorsements of former heads of the Council of Economic Advisors, former head of the Office of Management and Budget. This is the creme de la creme of the economics profession saying that the government's been engaged in what was effectively fraudulent accounting, and that we need to be telling the truth about our true fiscal position. We're actually in worse fiscal shape than Detroit by quite a degree. I mean, Social Security by itself is in worse fiscal shape than Detroit, if you really look at its situation. So it's not going to help anybody to lie about the future, about the actual fiscal situation. We have to start telling the truth, and that's what all these economists are saying.
The entire GDP, 10 to 15 years of everything produced by every single American and business in this country just to pay these future obligations, and just amounts to an enormous figure that I think it's hard for many people to wrap their minds around.
Yeah, you know, when you start, the country's been promising things to people at the local level, at the city, at the state level, and also at the federal level that they can't cover. This has been one ongoing Ponzi scheme. I define a Ponzi scheme as malfeasant accounting. And certainly Madoff was a master of not revealing the true situation, of providing misleading accounting. Enron did this. But these entities and the people learned this at the feet of Uncle Sam. Uncle Sam has been engaged in this kind of misleading accounting for decades. He's been putting all kinds of obligations off the books. The vast majority of the obligations are off the books. So in economics, we have a very clear prescription of how to do the thing right, and that's called the fiscal gap, and that's what this bill requires the government to start doing at the official level. And, you know, I can tell you what the fiscal gap is, because I can take the CBO numbers and transform them into the fiscal gap. But if the CBO does that and puts it on its website, then the press will start paying attention, the public will start to understand what's going on, and we'll have a change in policy. So the idea here is that the government do it at an official level to guide its fiscal policy using the fiscal gap, the idea being that we need to get the fiscal gap down to zero, because no country can sustain its policies with a positive fiscal gap. You have to pay for what you spend. That's true for any company, that's true for any household, that's also true for any government.
And, you know, as you aptly pointed out, we're looking at a Detroit-style situation, even eclipsing fiscal irresponsibility there nationwide. You know, David Walker, former head of the Government Accountability Office, has been a big proponent and endorsed your work. And he had this to say about your plan. I'm quoting here. In order to make better decisions for tomorrow's Americans, today's elected officials need to have better information. Nevertheless, we look at our U3 number, paints a sanguine picture of the national economy, but our former U6 number looks really unmanageable. How can legislators make informed decisions regarding spending with unreliable information at their fingertips?
They can't, and they've been... You know, they have an opportunity right now. We have now 8 senators who have endorsed the bill, 3 Republican, actually it's 9 senators, 3 Democrats and 6 Republicans. We need to get everybody to talk to their members of Congress, particularly their senators, and say, let's enact the INFORM Act so that we can have an honest discussion about how we're treating our kids. If you look at the endorsements by the 1,000-plus economists and the Nobel laureates. If you know the people like I do who've endorsed this bill, first of all, they're, you know, the very top people in the country. They're not, some are partisan, some are from the right, some are from the left, a lot of people from the center. But this is a, both, you know, the fact that you have people from the left and the right joining together and saying this is quite a statement. We've never seen anything like this in economics. We've never had 15 Nobel laureates endorse any piece of legislation. It's never happened. And we've never seen 1,000 economists endorse any piece of legislation, especially people that are so far apart politically. So economists can agree on one thing, which is not to lie to the public about our fiscal position. And that's what they're saying. Stop lying to the public. Start doing honest accounting. And everybody in the country who's listening to this, everybody in the country, everybody who's listening to this radio broadcast can send a letter to the head of the CBO and say, look, 1,000 economists, your colleagues, you're an academic economist, do what these people have asked. Don't wait for a bill to be passed. Just start doing it right now. And let's see if we can get it to happen. But we also need to have the legislation passed. And that requires everybody listening to, if need be, go down to Washington, find your senator, and sit down with your senator, the members of the top members of the staff, and say, we want you to endorse this bill. You know, a bunch of kids who were in their 20s went and got this a senator to agree to have this bill be drawn up, and now we have 1,000, you know, they got in touch with me and I helped draft it. And now we, and I went to work to get these endorsements, and we had an ad, full page ad in the New York Times with these 1,000 signatures, endorsements specified back in October. That cost over $65,000. We raised the funds to get that to happen. So things are happening here, but we need everybody as everybody to jump on this bandwagon and really get this law passed.
Well, you know, it's true. Your bipartisan effort here is unusual. I mean, to paraphrase Thomas Jefferson from your website, government plans using the funding term are simply stealing from our children's futures. And I think that's one of the interesting aspects of this INFORM Act. It has the potential to bring bipartisan efforts. I mean, as you already pointed out, the bill was introduced by senators from both parties, and the House of Representatives seems to be embracing it as well. As we wrap up here today, any other aspects of the act that you'd like to share with our listeners, please?
Well, it's not a right-wing conspiracy to cut any programs. It's not a left-wing conspiracy to raise taxes. It's just, you know, economists are not fundamentally political. This is the equivalent of the economics profession doing what the physics profession did back in the late 1930s when they got Einstein to write a letter to President Roosevelt warning him that the Germans might be developing an atomic bomb. This is the economist saying, look, we may have a bomb, a fiscal bomb, that we're planning under our kids' future, economic future. So let's at least be honest about what we're doing. And let's put everything on the books. And that's what the INFORM Act is all about. So as much help as I can get from your listeners, please give it to me and get the, and yourself and your kids, and get this bill passed.
Now, Professor Kotlikoff, we want to really thank you for taking time from your busy schedule today for us.
Thanks so much. Appreciate it.
Bill Murphy is at the helm of the Gold Antitrust Action Committee, GATA, with Chris Powell working on behalf of investors to expose the powers that be manipulating the precious metals market. Welcome back, Bill Murphy.
Great to be here, Chris. Thank you.
Let's begin the dialogue with the Detroit pension confiscation news. You know, as more details begin to emerge from the beleaguered city, it's now becoming clear that pensioners could expect to lose more than 80% of their benefits. This seems to be a theme that's, you know, starting to snowball as governments become bankrupt around the world and now even in our country. You know, on the surface, it seems somewhat deflationary, but I think that as investors begin to realize that ultimately it's, you know, the people that are going to have to pay for these municipal defaults, the safe haven factor of precious metals could start to, you know, make a comeback. Any thoughts?
Oh, yeah, we had Cyprus and Detroit, and there's concern there what the pension people that put their money in pensions are going to get, and there's some other municipalities and states under pressure, and Illinois is a good example. And this is after all this QE and the government trying to fix things with monetary stimulus, and it's liable to catch up to a lot of people. This has been percolating for some time, and now it's beginning to come to the fore.
I wanted to move on to, you know, the Bitcoin scenario. We saw that digital currency soar from under $5 to over 1,000 in less than a year. I'd like to know what odds you place on a sudden aha moment where investors rush into precious metals, similar to the Bitcoin phenomenon.
You know, first of all, God bless the Bitcoin people for having the audacity and creativity to do what they've done. I know a couple of guys that have been involved in the beginning, and they've made fortunes, and they deserve it. Good for them. And, of course, it's interesting because, you know, lately the government agencies or the SEC, a bunch of people all came out and blessed it. Now, you got to be scary about something like that when, of course, gold's just the opposite. We know what they've done to it with this suppression scheme this year, and it's been a nightmare. And I think at some point, and, of course, their orchestration down has reinforced the negativity at the moment. The sentiment's terrible, but all of a sudden, the bad guys, as we call them, the gold cartels, going to run out of ability to keep the price down with all the gold flowing to China, and the ETF disgorgement is going to run its course. And it's just going to be something where it's going to overtake the supply, and the gold cartel is going to have to retreat again like they did for 12 years, except this time the move up is liable to be violent. When it's going to start, we'll have to see, but it's coming.
You know, and I'd also like your thoughts on the Shanghai Gold Exchange, because, you know, as you mentioned, this raid on gold has just been music to the ears of Asian governments. There's some speculation now. John Ng is one of the latest to speculate that deliveries made on all the gold in Fort Knox worth of metal, 8,600 tons of gold, has been delivered now by the Shanghai Gold Exchange, and it's delivering huge amounts of gold. China consumed, according to one source, 1,700 tons of gold in just the first 8 months of this year. It's very close to the annual gold production in one country, and incidentally, they're also the world's largest producer.
That's pretty well documented now, Chris. I mean, honestly, in our commentary at the Metropole Cafe, through my source, we reported this 5 years before they announced years ago that they had 400 and they bought an extra 450 tons. None of this was accounted for by the establishment gold people, which were totally embarrassed because all they do is make their things match. They don't account for government coming out, gold coming out of the government coffers to suppress the price or anything. So they were stunned. And we've been all over this for years. They were accumulating it through private sources, and I won't get into that, but it's pretty well documented now that all, you know, sorts of tonnage you're talking about is going into China. They've got these different exchanges to deal with. They know it's coming. They know what the United States has done. They know that they have us trapped. I mean, it's stunning that in China there are 14 gold refineries. There are only three in North America. It's unbelievable. They are gearing up to something dramatic. People that know about what's going on behind the scenes in terms of the gold cartel, in terms of the Chinese, know that we're going to go to historic prices and well beyond. And We just got to get through this raid and let it run its course, and then up we go.
Now, I think it's an interesting point, and if we take a look at the newly affluent middle class in China, of course, this is a huge section of the populace, but we hear constantly of shortages for the yellow metal. So all of that metal is flowing somewhere. Also wanted to ask you about the investor love affair we've seen here with equities. Continues as funds flow away from zero-yielding debt and into stocks. However, when this risk play runs its course, huge money flows are likely to shift back to the commodity sector. I'd like to know what you think could trigger such an event.
Well, this is a big pet peeve of mine, because if you go over the past 14 months, gold goes down $500 an ounce on QE, and the Dow goes up some 2,500 points on the same news. It's ludicrous. If anything, gold should have gone up more instead of going the other way. So it's a trade that's, again, it's been orchestrated by the gold cartel and allies, and it's worked very well for them, but it's liable to go just the other way. I'm not a stock market guy, but I do feel pretty comfortable that we have an explosion coming in gold and silver, that and, of course, in the shares that are that correspond to them, and it's going to be quite something. We just got to get through this madness that they've set in motion, and as they set this in motion, as you talked about earlier, you've got countries like the Chinese and other people just saying, thank you very much for the cheap gold, and they have it. Believe me, the Chinese know what Ghana knows. And I've had three conference calls with the Chinese Investment Corporation, their sovereign wealth fund. The Russians know what we know. They've come to our conferences. The gold's going to be the big deal in the years to come, and this is just a prelude for what's coming.
And speaking of preludes of what's ahead, I'd like your thoughts on the big announcement from the Labor Department last week. The unemployment rate plunged from 7.3% down to 7%. That's quite a move lower. But if you look behind the headline figure, people are dropping out of the workforce at a record pace. And this is sort of gives you the illusion of a job increase. Take a look at the Bureau of Labor Statistics website. You can see the labor force participation rate has been plunging since 2008. And that's since the Great Recession began, and it never recovered. St. Louis Fed shows a similar chart. We haven't seen levels this bad since the 70s. And I think the severity of the decline is exacerbated. If you look at it over the past six decades, you see there's never been anything like this on record. I'd like to know, you know, what you think this means and portends for the economy and the markets.
Bottom line is they haven't got much bang for all their buck with this QE they put into the system. The velocity of turnover of money hasn't been there. A lot of the money is just going into the market, it appears. And as is pretty well talked about, the average person these days is not doing that well. The rich are getting richer. The banks are doing fine. Wall Street has been knocking them dead, but in terms of the average Joe and Jane, it's not that good a time, and they're falling further and further behind. And I think they're petrified if they stopped printing the money, what would happen? And as you've talked about, so pretty good year. I mean, the corrections in the stock market have been negligible, as everybody knows, and it's liable to set up something dramatic in next year.
It really makes one wonder what's left in their bag of tricks. Have they used up all the ammo in the arsenal? Because ultimately, this is going to require some new quantitative measure that probably no one has yet even thought up. Good news for precious metals investors. And I also wanted to discuss the disconnect between gold and the greenback. I mean, if this truly was a gold bear market, as the bears claim, one would expect to see the dollar soaring. But we're not seeing that. The greenback has been stuck on the lower end of a three-year bear market consolidation. So if the dollar can't sustain a meaningful rally with the metals off so sharply, it would seem to me as though the day of reckoning for the currency can't be far away.
I take the tact. It shows you how much the price has been suppressed. The euro's gone up 8 points in the last 14 months, and gold going down $500. So what's the relationship between the gold and the terms of when they want to manipulate the price down? I mean, it's hasn't been a thing. Now, I think that could change where they're hitting the wall in terms of how far they can stretch that. So I think the dollar's in trouble, and while it's had no effect on gold the past year, it's liable to have a big effect in next year.
Well, as we wrap up here, would you like to share any contact information with the listeners and any other activities that might be happening at Gotta?
Well, Chris Powell's been doing yeoman work, and we'll have something out again shortly. He's got his secretary treasurer, and you can find what he puts out at goddard.org. And I have a website, the Metropole Cafe. Been doing it 15 years, and people can sign up for a 2-week free trial and see if it's of value to them.
Well, hat tip for all the seminal work that you all are doing there.
Thank you, Chris. Anytime.
Well, this week Congress gave approval for a small-scale military operation in Syria, but some analysts are worried that a full-scale military conflict with the U.S. could be imminent. Gerald Celente joins me with his take on the situation and how it might affect the markets. He's the director of the Trends Research Institute. His team produces the Trends Journal. Welcome back, Gerald Celente.
Thank you, Chris.
You know, some media sources are suggesting that a showdown between the U.S. and Syria could lead to a potential conflict there in the Middle East, another front, if you will. Unlike some of their neighbors, I think you'd agree that Syria has a formidable military resources and presence. And sometimes these conflicts can get out of hand. Any comments?
Well, you go back and look at our top trend for 2013 in the Trends Journal. It was war, and we've been writing about the lead-up to this for a long time. And writing about that lead-up in previous Trends journals, we kept showing how the information coming out about what Syria was doing and who was involved has really been distorted to make the case for an attack rather than making it case for peace. And so I watched, for example, the recent Senate foreign intelligence hearings, and it was a disgrace listening to this charade that was going on. It reminded me of being in high school and listening to a principal and the students babble on. And then there was a report this past week in the Wall Street Journal analyzing what the so-called evidence is and really what it means, and it's two very different things. And the Wall Street Journal punched holes in just about all of it. So then when you see the report that came out from the Senate panel after the hearing, what they did was they changed the focus to, quote, change the momentum on the battlefield. So all of a sudden now, America is becoming involved in another foreign entanglement after losing Iraq, losing Afghanistan, causing a civil war in Libya, and now they're going to fix Syria? Of course there's going to be more destabilization. Oh, by the way, conveniently out of the news, hey, look what's going on over there in Egypt. Doesn't even make the newspapers anymore. And bloodshed continues, riots ensue, and destabilization is at levels that have never been seen before in recent history.
And, you know, we're seeing record oil prices, some sources suggesting that we might even revisit those 2008 levels that were staggering, you know, up to $147 a barrel for West Texas Intermediate crude. That has a tendency to, you know, put downward pressure on economic output as essentially everyone is paying more at the pumps to get to and from work and wherever else they need to travel, as well as our transportation systems. Any thoughts on how this developing situation in the Gulf there might affect it?
Well, that's part of it. The other part is, and you pointed out, I mean, we're looking at a Syria country of 20 million people. Let's suppose your family was wiped out and you lost everything that you had. You think you want to see revenge attacks? So now put this into perspective, Chris. Go back to this past April, and there was the Boston Marathon bombing. They closed down 100 square miles to hunt for a 19-year-old kid that was hiding in a boat. 100 square miles. Business stopped. A state of siege ensued. Now imagine, suppose there's a revenge attack at a 9/11 scale. Suppose there's a dirty bomb, for example, that would go off in San Francisco, or a suitcase-sized nuke. or biological warfare, this country goes on stop. And suppose the same thing happened in France or one of America's other allies. It'll destroy the economy. You have to understand. You don't have to understand. I say that, you know, just in putting it into perspective. I want to make this 100% clear. The United States military has not won a war since World War II. They lost Korea. They lost Vietnam. They lost Iraq. They lost Afghanistan. They destroyed Libya. Civil war ensues. And now they're going to fix Syria. And the other level of hypocrisy, by the way, is all of this, oh, my God, he used chemical weapons, and ostensibly 1,300 people have been killed. And we don't know who did what, by the way. I don't believe any of the information, unless you believe, remember the Maine, the Gulf of Tonkin incident that didn't happen, or the weapons of mass destruction, then you would take everything that they're saying at face value. Be that as it may, if you want to talk about hypocrisy and using weapons of mass destruction, hey, how about a couple of atom bombs in Hiroshima and Nagasaki? Oh, you like that Agent Orange that they sprinkle throughout Vietnam, or that napalm? What about all that white phosphorus and depleted uranium the United States has been using and has used in Iraq and Afghanistan and in other countries? Oh, Israel included, by the way, with the white phosphorus. And how about also what we're seeing going on if you kill somebody with carpet bombs or buster bunking bombs? What's the difference? Dead is dead. And to make all this thing about, oh, they use sarin gas, you know, how World War II that is, or World War I, and when you're using all these sophisticated weaponries. Hey, a drone is okay. You could kill with drones, but no unofficial FDA-approved chemical weapons. Oh, by the way, 1,400 dead in Egypt over the last 2 weeks. That's okay. They kill them with bullets. You can't kill them with gas.
You talk about our failure, you might say, to regulate our military efforts. And I'd like to go back to, you mentioned the last war that we really won, and that was World War II. And you might recall how we rebuilt the Axis powers, Italy, Germany, Japan. We helped rebuild, and as a result, the world looked at us and said, has there ever been a nation so benevolent that they actually defeat a power, and instead of horrible reparations that we saw during the Versailles Treaty, we actually rebuilt these nations. Now, fast forward to today, and unlike the little mini conflict we actually won with Storm and Norman Schwarzkopf, the four-day war, that was maybe a model that we need to look back to. A four-day war, we went in, we got business taken care of, and then we pulled out instead of trying to micromanage the scenario. Any comment?
Well, yes. My comment is, I'm speaking now from Colonial Kingston, New York. As a matter of fact, tomorrow marks the 236th year that the New York State was actually formed right here in Kingston, the first capital of New York State, in 1777. It was on September 6, 1777. And I'm reminded, of course, about the founding fathers and General Washington among them, who in his farewell address warned about becoming involved in foreign entanglements. It's not our business. And as I'm here in Colonial Kingston, New York, and I see the difficulties that this city is having with its number of its population, I want to see my money going to restoring Kingston or Cleveland or Detroit or Camden. Not, you know, $40 million a day, they're estimating, just in some aspects of a war against Syria. So this to me is way out of balance. And there is no such thing as going in and getting out, because if you look back to 1991, you know, the rest of the 90s were involved in a war with Iraq. You know, people forget the no-fly zones and bombs over Baghdad every time. It was a wag-the-dog moment every couple of months. So no, I'm totally opposed to it as being an American and believing in the foundations of this country. And secondly, to see the lunacy, all anyone has to do, again, at that Senate hearing and listening to them babble on. Oh, and by the way, talking about babbling on, I am sick and tired. I don't want to hear it again. That if only women were in charge, there would be no war. I heard Barbara Boxer going on and on about the need for war. I heard this woman, the senator from New Hampshire, DeHaan, I believe her name is, or something like that. And then I saw that clip of Nancy Pelosi babbling on about a five-year-old grandson and what he had to say about the Syrian war. And I'll tell you why she was quoting the five-year-old grandson, because that's the mind of these people. They got the mind of five-year-olds. There's not a man or woman among them. Where are all the people saying no more to war? How much more money and men do we have to lose, and how many more people does America have to kill before they stop this madness? And here's my, you know, I have General Salenti's four rules of peace. You're the commander-in-chief. You want to take out Assad? Great. Go take him out. Hey, they just found the bones of King Richard III recently. He got killed in the Battle of the Roses. I loved it, the War of the Roses. And they found him under a parking lot. That's how important he was. So when the king died, the war ended. And anybody out there that wants to support the war, send your kids, send yourself, send your money, send your wife. Go do the fighting. Keep me out of it. And number three, when they retaliate, don't go, oh, they hate our freedom and liberty, and they're terrorists. No, it's payback, the golden rule, do unto others you have them do unto you. So again, you know, this is all very clear. If everything is in place, if you want this war, you pay for it, you go fight it, and keep me out of it. It's going to be another losing battle. Nothing will be accomplished. And I listen to these people on this Senate hearing again. Well, we have every contingency in place to make sure that if the first contingency doesn't work, the second one will.
I'd like to touch on a couple of key anecdotes here. Firstly, you talk about this idea that war is good. You know, it reminds one of George Orwell's 1984, you know, war is peace and endless war. But that takes me back to the 1990s with General Schwarzkopf. If you've had a chance to read his book, it's really quite illuminating. He was one of these amazing folks who actually fought in Vietnam, and he was the type of commander who would run back through open machine gun fire to pick up one of his wounded comrades. And this actually happened. He ran through a minefield one time, not knowing whether he would lose a leg or a limb, and carried a wounded soldier back to the helicopter. He earned several medals just for that one event. And the reason I mention this is that when he talked about his tenure there at taking our troops in on that four-day, 100-hour mini battle or war in the early 90s, he talks about how he hates war. And he knows the horror of it and not get entangled in one of these 10-year or longer Vietnam-like scenarios where you could arguably say we're in currently in the Middle East, a quagmire.
And it wasn't like I was intelligent enough to know that they lied us into it. There was no Gulf of Tonkin incident as they reported it. It was a total lie. I was just a young kid, you know, 18 years old, and I couldn't imagine me in a foreign country with a lot of weight on my back getting shot at. There are some guys like Schwarzkopf that liked that trip. And what did he do? We killed 3 million people over there? For what? For a lie? And now we're doing business with the Vietnamese? And I see Hillary Clinton over there when she was Secretary of State saying how we're going to defend the Vietnamese against the Chinese in their dispute over these islands? The whole war thing is a big lie. What? Look, listen to General Dwight D. Eisenhower, leaving office, five-star general, supreme commander of the Allied forces, and he warns the American people that the military-industrial complex is taking over, robbing us of the future of the genius of the scientists, the sweat of our labors, and the future of our nation. And look at the future of our nation throughout the Cold War and all these wars. Look at how this country is going downhill so quickly. Look at the gap between the rich and the poor. Look at the wages that people are not making. Look at how 97% of the jobs that are being created are part-time jobs, Chris. This whole war thing is draining the morality, lifeblood, and life out of this country. That was Schwarzkopf's trip. I'm totally against. Look, I'm not a pacifist. I'm a second-degree close combat practitioner. If anybody tries to do anything to me, I will do everything I have to do to stop them. And if I need to kill them, if they're trying to kill me, I will. I'm not a pacifist. I mind my own business. I love this language. Militants attack U.S. base in Afghanistan. Militants attack U.S. base. What if this was reversed? Would it be militants, Afghan militants attack, American militants attack?
Afghan base in Alabama, in Birmingham, Alabama.
This is sickness to me. This is total sickness. It's a delusion. And I'm telling you, all you have to do is watch the players. This guy Corker, what a corker he is, shooting his little mouth off. I went through the list of all these guys at that Senate hearing. A bunch of chicken hawks and draft dodgers. Every one of these loudmouths, this Representative Engel we have over here in New York. And all they want to do is go fight. Go fight. Go lead the charge. I don't want you taking my money. And that's the way I look at it. I want every cent of my money staying in the United States. And these people are now taking us to another losing disaster. And worse than that, as I wrote in the Trends Journal, continue to write and have been writing over the years, they're leading us into World War III. And you know that saying by Einstein. I don't know how the Third World War will be fought, but I know the Fourth will be fought with sticks and stones.
Exactly, because we don't know just how things might get out of hand. You know, I was reading an interesting article the other day about World War II and the events that led up to the horrific nightmare of that terrible global war. All sides were convinced it would be just a quick little war, and before you know it, things will be settled and everything, peace will be. It was just their officials that threw them into the conflict. We never know just how things might unfold. You know, you have Russia and China that are adamantly opposed to any conflict with Syria. Of course, I'm sure you've read that Russia has armed Syria with many of their protective missiles, some of which have incredibly long range. Why do we want to antagonize the entire world? And, you know, that leads me back to your comments about George Washington. You know, he was one of the most failed commanders in world history. He lost virtually every conflict he ever went into in the French-American Indian War. Look at the American Revolution. We almost lost that as well. But so to hear someone like that say, we don't need to get entangled with these conflicts around the world.
And it's not only him. It's you go through all the founding fathers. They were all opposed to it. And here we are in the midst of it. Now, I ask you this question. You name me one, just one great success that has come out of Washington when they've started, whether it's a war on drugs, a war in the Middle East, to fix education with their education czars. Name me one successful program that you could look at to Washington and say, wow, these are a bunch of intelligent people. I feel very confident that they know what they're doing. Tell me one.
It's hard. It's hard to do.
Maybe no, tell me one.
Meals on Wheels, maybe? I love that program.
Well, it's not, you know, that's it's more local.
Yeah.
You know, and it's a little thing.
No,
Losers.
Yeah.
They're losers.
No,
they can't
I agree.
Balance
with you.
The budget. Why would any self-respecting adult listen to what these people have to say? That's the way I look at it. And you know the motto taught to me by my dear father, may his soul rest in peace, think for yourself. And that's what I'm saying. I'm not saying you should think like this. As I see it, these guys and women are a bunch of losers. Leaders, they couldn't lead me across the street. And again, if they want to lead, lead the charge. Our forecast is this. If the United States goes to war with Syria, as I wrote in the Trends Journal that went out as the top trends for 2013, it's the beginning of the first great war of the 21st century.
Well, you know, there are some folks who are claiming that we're already in the early stages of World War III. You just don't declare war many times until long after the stage has been set and the chess pieces are already in motion.
Well, that's exactly it. That's what we've been writing about. And again, you know, I've been writing about this for a number of years. People waiting for an Archduke Ferdinand moment? You know, now it's official. You know, I mean, this thing is going on. Look, let's make this clear. There's a war in Syria. There's a war in Libya. There's a war in Yemen. There's a war in Bahrain. There's a war in Congo. There's a war in the Sudan. They're warring throughout many nations in Africa. There's civil wars going on, but they don't call them that. And those civil wars are what's going on in Greece and in Spain and in Portugal with this rampant unemployment levels, youth unemployment levels, likes of which have never been seen before. You have a civil war going on in Egypt. Oh, by the way, the United States government has still refused to call it a military coup over there in Egypt. I mean, it's just your imagination that guy Sisi is in charge over there, always wears that military uniform and those dark glasses that's right out of a comic book. That's only your imagination that the military overthrew it. Our government says it wasn't a military coup. So as you go around the world, you can see this destabilization. And then you start adding in the more economics into it, because that's really a lot of what goes on behind the scenes. And as you well know, being with Goldseek, you see what's going on in the emerging markets and how they've lost 11%. You know, they're down 11% this year already. And you see a currency crisis emerging with the Brazilian real, with the Indian rupee, with the Turkish lira, and on and on. You can see these currencies that are going through all these problems as all this hot money is drying up with the fear that interest rates are going up. So you're going to see more and more destabilization. And you know my saying, when all else fails, they take you to war. And that's what they're doing now.
I mean, it's a favorite tactic for supposedly pulling economies out of the quagmire because, well, folks start working and spills over into the economy. But in the final analysis, I stick with your earlier comments, and that is we don't need any part of it. The blowback from this one day will be simply more than this nation can manage. And as we wrap up here, any parting comments, any topics that you'd like to share as we close?
Well, I think it's very important what we're seeing now also with gold, you know, losing a lot of its strength recently that has gained, or some of its strength, and the fear, of course, with the pullback on tapering and stopping some of the hot money flowing in. I believe that they're not going to be able to taper too much, particularly now that they're saying in the emerging markets that the only way to save their failing currencies is to raise interest rates, so that their currencies aren't depreciated even more. Well, how do you raise interest rates in a declining economy without destroying the economy? So I think any kind of tapering, any type of pullbacks is only going to be temporary, because they're going to have to juice the economies with more hot money. And when that hot money flows in, gold goes higher.
No, exactly. You know, I think the markets have either factored it in or priced in most of the taper talk by now, and I think they're starting to look for future economic growth. And, you know, we're also seeing surprising growth out of China, unexpectedly strong economic numbers. The Eurozone looks like it might be finally turning the corner there in its recession. If you bring that all together, that economic improvement certainly could bode well for the precious metals after having such a difficult 2013 so far.
Well, actually, I see more instability, which is going to be stronger for gold. And I don't see I see the recovery. Yeah, and I see the recovery in Europe being temporary. And I know also that there's a huge debt bubble floating in China that's going to have to be addressed. And the government, despite their calls recently not to keep pumping in money, are doing so. And that's going to reverse as well. So I see more instability coming in the coming months, but I do see that they're going to try to do everything, both in the United States and in Europe, as we already saw at the ECB keeping interest rates near their record lows, to keep the economy propped up to Christmas time, at least. And so that means more hot money flowing in, because they're not going to risk bringing down retail sales at a time when retail sales are already soft.
Very good. Well, low interest rates and safe haven buying, certainly music to the ears of our listeners today. Any contact information you'd like to share with the listeners?
Well, you saw the New Trends Journal. It's history before it happens. It's all revamped, a whole new look. And I recommend that everyone consider it's money-back guarantee, nothing to lose, trendsjournal.com, trendsjournal.com. And I can guarantee you, Chris, it's the only magazine where you can read history before it happens.
Now, you've assembled a fantastic team and hat tip for such an economic think tank. You know, and that's what we really need. We need, I don't know, like a university of like-minded individuals who are thinking outside of the box and not afraid to push the limits, because that's the only way we get to the truth. Gerald Celente, thanks so much.
Hey, thank you, Chris.
Hey Chris, this is Robert Ian with ConquerChange.com. It's Friday the 13th, and this week a news release was issued by Lender Processing Services that should give anyone who is looking for any kind of bright spot in the housing market a real pause for concern. As it stands, 48% of outstanding home equity lines of credit, better known as HELOCs, were originated between 2004 and 2006. Most HELOCs have draw periods of 10 years, where the consumer pays interest only. After the 10-year draw period expires, the payments become fully amortizing, requiring both principal and interest to be paid back. The impact of this is significant. A recent Reuters report identified Bank of America as having $8 billion of home equity balances resetting in 2014. After that, $57 billion resets. Chase has $9 billion of their home equity balances resetting in 2014 and $22 billion after that. HELOCs written before 2004 that have already begun resetting are having repayment problems right now. Those that were written during the run-up to the height of the housing bubble are likely to have their own share of delinquencies from 2014 to 2016. Why? Interest rates are rising. Unemployment is rising. Real inflation is rising. Income is dropping. And of course we have national health care to pay for. We are at the doorstep of the next housing crisis in the United States. The small rise recorded in housing prices the past 18 months will turn out to be nothing more than a dead cat bounce. The stage has been set for the final destruction of what remains as the most endangered species on the planet, the middle class. Ben Bernanke has been buying mortgage-backed securities like they're going out of style. And they are. The Fed is the buyer of last resort. However, the greater fool theory will prevail. Janet Yellen will buy even more mortgage-backed securities as quantitative easing increases against the backdrop of the next housing crisis. Just as the mainstream media has finished convincing many people and pundits that it's now safe to go back outside into the marketplace, the marketplace, which has been dressed up like lipstick on a pig, is going to assert itself and severely punish those who have painted the markets with that deceptive shade of red lipstick, which will turn out to be a deadly combination of blood and red ink. Chris, on February 21st and 22nd, I'll be speaking at the second annual Liberty Mastermind Symposium in Las Vegas, with 15 speakers, 3 panel discussions on one amazing day. Details are on my website, and until next time, this is Robert Ian with ConquerChange.com, reminding you to follow us on Twitter at ConquerChange. Thanks, Chris.